Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in, this is Wotan's day, David Lane's favorite day, that's right. And it's a drizzly day here in northern Indiana, north central Indiana. And it is the, get my microphone out of the way here so I can see, March the 19th, 2014, Wotan's day, yeah. This is the day I go to luncheon with my class of 56, my high school class of 56. Once a month we get together, well, starting now, because during the winter time they close it down. But anyhow, I get to go out there and see how old all those people look and look in the mirror and see how young I look. Yeah, that's for sure. I like that Hank Williams the Third. Yeah, he sticks to good old country. Down home country music, man. Well, I think I got a whole bunch of stuff for the show here. If I can look around and find it. I was messing around with the electronics last night, trying to get things running a little better. I know. I've had some glitches this week. Anyhow, we're back at it. And I think what we're going to do is start off with the Church of What's Happening Now. Yeah. And that one about there ain't no Jesus, because I'm telling you, you can't fight with one arm tied behind you. And if you're sticking with Christianity, Christ insanity, you can't do it. You can't really work for white liberation properly and be bending your knee to this imaginary Jew God. That's so. I'm going to have to force feed you a little bit, and you might say, well, you go plumb straight to hell, Metzger. I love my baby Jesus. Well, I remember that song. Let's see, what was the name of it? My buddy used to sing it all the time. I got a plastic Jesus on my dashboard. I used to be able to sing it all the time. I'm going to have to remember that and sing it for you. Yeah, either that or get it sung by somebody else and put it on there. Yeah. Well, let me see if I can pick out one of these tracks here that's guaranteed to piss everybody off. I don't want to piss everybody off, but a whole lot of people. You need pissed off, yeah. There's a lot of things out there that should be pissing you off. Oh, yeah, I was watching a good sort of a semi-funny, sort of funny show that they've got on Fox TV now. But I get it on Hulu, and it's Rake, R-A-K-E. The guy's funny as hell. But sitting there enjoying the damn show last night, and here's this English broad in the guy's apartment, and all of a sudden the nigger comes up, and first thing you know, they're in bed. So I just turned off the television and did something else. Now, I'm telling you, they're just shoving it down our throat. They're nigger boarding us 24 hours a day now. In the ads, in the movies, in the TV shows, in the sports, it's nigger board, nigger board, nigger board. That's sort of, I think it's sort of like a Jew joke. I think they're just laughing at us, you know. You boys will take about anything, won't you? Well, let's start off here with No Man Behind the Myth. See if I can get this going here. How about this? Okay. Supposed to be gone. Oh, yeah. Let's see here. What the hell's going on?
History embroidered with propaganda, such as we find, for example, in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, and a fantasy placed into a historical setting. Such an example would be Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. The Jesus Tale is very much in the latter category, a fictional drama in which a stereotypic hero has been intruded into a more or less realistic historical landscape. As we would expect from a fictional creation, there exists not a single contemporary reference to such a character, not a single genuine artifact, nothing to substantiate that he ever walked the earth. The traditional authorized version of Christian origins is a Big Bang theory. It suggests that one fine day, the only begotten son of God materialized in a virgin's womb. He grew to manhood, assembled his disciples, imparted his wisdom, died, and rose again. From this a religion was born. How far should the rational thinker buy into this story? The idea of Jesus convinces many that someone must lie beneath the encrusted legends. Many, of course, reduce the Christian superstar to a dimly perceived good man, who perhaps said some wise words, fell foul of Roman and Jewish authorities, and managed to get himself crucified. The Big Bang theory now boils down to little more than Christianity exists, it must have begun somewhere, it began with a single character, here's my version of who he really was. And favourites include an itinerant philosopher, or a religious reformer, a pacifist like Gandhi, or a militant like Che Guevara. In fact, Jesus has been reformed 100 times. One thing of which historians and New Testament scholars are well aware is the trajectory by which the Jesus tale developed from an original text. Matthew, Luke, and even the fourth gospel build on a brief original tale without miracles and post-death appearances, written at an uncertain date by an anonymous author. Church tradition alone identifies this as Mark. Matthew took the story off in one direction, and he packed the text with prophecy. Luke, in contrast, trawled through the works of Josephus for cool tidbits of historical accuracy. Whatever else, eyewitness testimonies they are not, and the story was all but unknown until the second half of the second century. Aware of these difficulties, New Testament scholars suggest a number of traditions preceded the gospel tales. And what do these earlier traditions tell us of Jesus? The Essenes anticipated Christianity in a number of respects, as did the Therapeutes of Egypt, held by the church historian Eusebius as early Christian monks, yet they were established well before the Christian era. What then are we to make of the thinly drawn life of Jesus? It certainly appears to owe an extraordinary amount to Jewish scripture, whether drawn from Adam, Moses, Enoch, Melchizedek, Elijah, Elisha, etc. And it's a vast anticipation of the words and deeds of Jesus. Christian apologetics uses the words fulfillment, but a simple word copying explains the same. What are we to make of the multitude of parallels to Jesus' lore to be found in ancient world mythology? Even the embarrassed church fathers spoke of diabolical mimicry. It seems that Satan himself clearly understood the true message of the Jewish prophets and was thus able to preempt Christianity centuries before the arrival of Jesus by copycat gods. In fact, we have absolutely no trace or mention of Jesus' exploits anywhere until the Gospels were written decades after the purported events. Desperate to penetrate this fog, some scholars strive to identify an early layer of teaching said to derive from an historical Jesus. But does a sayings tradition really point to a single author of wise words? The Bible itself provides an answer. We have a sayings collection in the book of Proverbs, which is attributed to Solomon, but it was standard practice in the ancient world to lend authority and prestige to new material by falsely accrediting a prestigious figure from the past. But even more fatal to the claim of a sayings tradition is the patent failure of anyone to record any of the supposed astounding new teachings at the time. If a great multitude throughout Syria, Galilee and the Judea heard and believed, how odd that no one recorded those sparkling gems of wisdom. The truth is that Christianity grew from neither a god nor a man, but out of what had gone before. A human Jesus was no more necessary than was a human Horus, Dionysus, Mithras, etc. Can we explain the emergence of Christianity without its superstar? Of course we can. For two centuries the Christian movement languished, and thanks to civil war it got its big chance. It was the ultimate product of ancient religious syncretism. But it isn't history. It isn't truth. It's more astounding rubbish from the New Testament.
So there, that's from the Church of What's Happening Now here at Tommy's Place. That's right. The Robert J. Matthews Memorial Bunker right here where we hold our Church of What's Happening Now once in a while. So might as well get ready for it, because you're going to get a little bit every few days, I'll tell you that. Because I don't play this game anymore. I've been at it too long. Took too many years to get out of that Jesus cult, and too many churches, too many lost hours, too much worrying, too much thinking about heaven and hell and all that kind of crap. It all derives from the reverence of the sun. And most of the Bible is based really upon the zodiac. It tells you in there too. And so anyhow, you see, most civilizations still revere the sun quite a bit. You know, look at Japan; they even have the sun as a symbol on their flag, and which is good. I don't know where they got it from us, or what happened there, but I know that our people traveled around the world, but anyhow, you find sun reverence in just about every culture and race, and that's good, because it makes sense. It makes sense, boys.
Iraq, under whatever lies and pretenses could be ginned up, which is what Bush and Cheney did, Clinton said no, but the original plan is to surround the state of Israel with friendly regimes who, if not friendly, are at least controlled by the American neoconservatives and backed by American military force. That's what this is all about. This has nothing to do with geopolitics in the sense of balancing the political drives of different competing forces. This has to do strictly, totally, with Israel. Every single neocon in the original group, with few exceptions, who wrote the statement, the project for a new American century, are American Jews. And they are American Jews of the sort that most American Jews are not. In other words, the neoconservatives are the ones who are willing to risk nuclear confrontation. They don't care in order to prove their bona fides to people like Netanyahu and the Likud party in Israel. These are people who are willing to drive the world to the worst possible scenario you can think of in order to protect the Israelis, the government of Israel, the state of Israel. Now, if that sounds, I'll wait for the emails to say, you anti-Semitic bastard. If that sounds anti-Semitic to you, I've said this before, I really don't care. I don't care how you interpret that if you refuse to see the truth of it. And it's not my truth. I'm just a messenger. You can research this yourself. This is not some anti-Jewish, right-wing, frothing, white supremacist, neo-Nazi crap that comes from people like Robert Perry or what we've talked about.
Wait a minute.
Or from anyone else. This is just simple truth.
You're talking about me.
And you can verify it and validate it on your own. Or, if you find what I'm saying is offensive to your Jewish sensibilities, you can just sit back on your ass and say, what an anti-Semitic schmuck this guy is. Really? Okay. Finishing. As dangerous and even crazy as this neocon vision is, which raises the specter of a possible nuclear confrontation between the United States and Russia, the neocons clearly appear back in control of U.S. foreign policy. And they almost can't lose in terms of their own self-interest, whichever way the Ukraine crisis breaks. If Putin backs down in the face of U.S. ultimatums on Ukraine and Crimea, the neocons can beat their chests and argue that similar ultimatums should be presented to other neocon targets, such as Syria and Iran. And if those countries don't submit to the ultimatums, then there will be no choice but to let the U.S. bombings begin. In other words, more shock and awe. On the other hand, if Putin refuses to back down and Crimea votes to abandon Ukraine and reattach itself to Russia, which has ties to Crimea dating back to Catherine the Great in the 1700s, then the neocons can ride the wave of official Washington's outrage, demanding that Obama renounce any future cooperation with Putin and thus clear the way for heightened confrontations with Syria and Iran. Let me digress from Perry. This is exactly what has happened over the past 3 days. Back to Perry. Even if Obama can somehow continue to weave his way around the neocon war demands for the next 2+ years, his quiet strategy of collaborating with Putin to resolve difficult disputes with Syria and Iran will be dead in the water. The neocons can then wait for their own sails to fill when either President Hillary Clinton or a Republican, likely to need neocon support, moves into the White House in 2017. But the neocons don't need to wait that long to start celebrating. They have weathered the storm. Robert Perry, writing this piece at consortiumnews.com, he also writes that his pieces are carried at Truth Dig and all sorts of places around the web.
Well, here's a little interesting note from the La Penites in France, described as a faithful supporter of France's National Front. Marie-Louise J. seems like a perfect candidate to stand for the far-right party in the country's upcoming municipal elections. I wonder how far right they are. I think they're getting too old to be too far right. There was just one problem. She passed away on February the 18th, age 96. But this did not stop the FN from including her as a candidate in the town of, I'm not even going to try that, just north of Paris. The election scheduled for March 23rd. Work on a list system. Parties can put forward a list of candidates for each municipality, and the majority of the councilors are drawn from the list that receives the most votes. So we got a dead lady at 96, that's running for office over there in France. That's typical of the right wing. I mean, come on. You gotta get some young blood in there, boys. Also, on that, news came at the same time that this La Pennites was hit by another potential embarrassment over its candidate list. Yeah, after they discovered that 80 of their candidates across France were foreigners from other EU countries. Come on, man. The party has frequently voiced its opposition to non-French citizens, even those from the EU, voting in local elections. The party lists for the towns of St. Marie and La Mire Corbus each featured one Romanian candidate, while a Bulgarian is standing for the party in Villeurbanne. There are also three Spanish citizens on the list, party list, and around 20 Portuguese candidates across the. I thought that La Pen. I thought those La Penites were French nationalists. What about that? Well, I knew we'd get into the water wars one of these days, and it's coming on. You better believe it when it gets down to where there's just not enough water. There are going to be water wars. We've had them in this country before. Across the parched American West, the long drought has set off a series of fierce legal and political battles over who controls an increasingly dear treasure, water. Just outside this minuscule farm town, Frank DiStefano was feeding a 500-acre cotton crop with water from the Brazos River 16 months ago, when state regulators told him and hundreds of others on the river to shut down their pumps. A sprawling petrochemical complex at the junction of the Brazos and the Gulf of Mexico held senior rights to the river's water, and with the Brazos shriveled, it had run short. The petrochemical complex, color that predatory capitalist. See, the corporations are going to nail down this water, and if you don't know it now, probably every little town, every town in the country, a corporation owns your water, as they do right here in the town I live next to. They don't own my well, though, yet. State regulators ordered DiStefano and others with lesser rights to make up the deficit. But they gave cities and power plants along the Brazos a pass, concluding that the public health and safety overrode the farmers' own water rights. That's what they always do to farmers. If they're going to short anybody, it's going to be the yeomanry farmer. Not the corporate farmer, because he figures a way out of it. But family farmers, forget it. Now DiStefano and other farmers in the court arguing that state is wrong, and so far they're winning. Well, that's odd. That can't go on. That can't go on forever. I wonder what that's all about. Farmers winning against the petrochemicals? Quote, I understand cities need water and people need water, but it kind of gets to me how agriculture is pushed to the back of the line, he said. We're on pins and needles wondering when the next call is going to be made. It's hard enough to make a living without things like this. Well, you see, these cities are filling up. Filling up. Illegal aliens and everybody. People from all over the world coming in there, fill them up. These big cities are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Even the regional cities are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But you know what? I never hear progressives talking about too many people. Rarely ever hear that, you know? They talk about all these other problems, but the main problem is too many people coming into the country. And also, we're extracting too much of our agriculture to be shipped overseas. We're going to need it here one of these days. And so I always say, you know, I can't understand the same guys that will say, what do they say, these guys, these progressives? They're always standing up for this stuff of immigration. Well, why would you stand up for immigration when increased immigration consumes more of your agriculture, consumes more of your oil and gasoline, consumes everything else? They're hypocrites. Every progressive I listen to is a total damn hypocrite, and the Republicans, they just snicker because they're in the corporations' pockets, and they're going to play the game however the corporations want to go. Residents of the arid West have always scrapped over water, but years of persistent drought are now intensifying those struggles. And the explosive growth, more people, and thirst, more people of Western cities and suburbs is raising their stakes to an entirely new level. In South Texas, along the Gulf Coast, southwest of Houston, the state has cut off deliveries of river water to rice farmers for 3 years to sustain reservoirs that supply booming Austin about 100 miles upstream. In Nevada, a coalition ranging from the environmentalists to the Utah League of Women Voters filed federal lawsuits last month to seek to block a pipeline that would supply Las Vegas with groundwater from an aquifer straddling the Nevada-Utah border, and there's a reason for that. It's a dangerous situation to the aquifer, but... Well, there's two points here. One, the cities are taking more and more water because more and more people, more non-white people. But agribusiness is taking more and more for agriculture that they're shipping out of the country. And much more than we need to feed ourselves here in this country. So you got two sins there if you believe in sin. Well, anyhow, that's raise enough crops for the present population or less, and let the hell the rest of it go back to seed. A lot of these Western states are just going to become a dust bowl, and that's just it. If you don't think so, you just wait and see. Let's see here. In Colorado, officials in the largely rural west slope of the Rocky Mountains are imposing stiff restrictions on requests to ship water across the mountains to Denver and the rest of the state's populous eastern half. Fearing for their existence, Colorado farm towns on the Arkansas River have mobilized to block sales of local water rights to Denver's fast-growing suburbs. Now you can see what's going on here, don't you? We're moving towards water wars. And in a way, this is good because it will force states to become more sovereign and more restrictive and more turned inward to protect their own people in the state, which will make the federal government's job a lot harder to keep you enslaved in its totality. You see what I mean? Anything that divides and centralizes on the state level and below the state level is good for the white race. And as far as all this raising more and more corn and all this kind of stuff and shipping it out of the country and all this coal, it's they're befouling the environment with this coal and the people getting very sick from coal production. Well, most of that coal's going out of the country. You got to understand that. You know, so, well, we got to sell it. We won't have any money. Well, you know who's got the money, like that McCready family down there in West Virginia where they've had about 50 people killed in the mines. They got the money. The working man gets shit and shoved in it. Don't forget it. In Arizona, activists and federal government are fighting plans to tap groundwater used by a massive housing development. More people, more non-white people, a move that would reduce the water level of the protected river. Kansas accused Colorado and Nebraska of allowing their farmers to divert Kansas' share of the Republican River, which flows through all three states. A similar dispute between New Mexico and Texas is before the U.S. Supreme Court. I remember when I ran for Congress in 1980, I said, you got to start building water desalinization plant to furnish water to the cities. I don't care. You're going to have to run a deficit, but you're going to have to start building them up and down the coast. And also the farmers are going to have to go to drip irrigation whenever possible and get rid of this open trench irrigation. You know how much they listen to me? Well, you see, I'm not a congressman. They don't give a shit until it's an emergency and it's the end of the line. And think of all the pollution that's going into the groundwater and so forth, too, that's making a lot of the water unpotable. And they want to build that damn Keystone Pipeline right across the biggest freshwater aquifer in North America. And what if that thing goes to phooey? It's only got one wall, you know. It's not got two wall. And if these aquifers go, then believe me, the West is shut down. That's it. California, in the midst of historic drought so far, has witnessed but a few local skirmishes. See? Skirmishes. In January, environmentalists and sports fishermen sued to halt the drilling of hundreds of new groundwater wells sought by Central Valley farmers, saying more pumping would lower stream levels. And then all this cracking, fracking, pouring all these chemicals into the ground that's screwing the water up. And oh boy, we're headed. It's going to be an interesting ride, but for the outlaw, for the lone wolf, I think it's going to be good, because there's a certain percentage of our race that are going to rise to it, and it's going to get a little bit like the old West, and I think that's going to be great. Yeah. That may not last long, said Stuart Somach, a Sacramento water rights lawyer. California farmers have long grumbled about big city designs on their water. Screw the city. But the city will send the army out and all that kind of stuff, and they're whatever they want to send out, and beat down the locals. See, this is called serfdom. We're back into serfdom. The big cities will control pretty much the goodies and the water and so forth, and the outlying areas will be just stuck. But they'll start shooting. Yeah, they'll start sniping. They'll start killing off these people, come out, take their water. They'll start breaking the pipelines and everything else. That's down the road a ways, but it's coming. Northern California has long grumbled about being the spigot that supplies most of the water to the dry South, and that's why they've had a bill in to separate the state of California into two sections, southern and northern. And that's going to get more serious as time goes on, and technically, it won't make a lot of difference, but it'll make a lot of difference to the people. The people in the north are going to just cut off the spigot to the south. Let non-white Los Angeles go to hell. We're very close to the time when the people are going to start staking out rights. We're right at the cusp, Stomach said. If this drought persists, depending on how state and federal agencies react, you're going to get some real conflicts going. Actually, the laws that govern most of the West water seem tailor-made for fighting. Well, it's happened before. Back in the old days, the ranchers and farmers used to fight over water. And the ranchers, big ranchers, would be sort of like the corporations trying to fence in and cut off the water so the farmers couldn't get any. And there were gunfights over it. In many places, the rules for owning or using groundwater are still in flux. In Texas, landowners own the groundwater beneath their property, but a neighbor pumping groundwater from the same aquifer can siphon it away without penalty. See, this is what happened that caused that first war over there in Iraq. Saddam said what the hell is the name of that little English cut off of their country? The British just took southern part of their country and just cut it off for the oil business and the whole bit. Anyhow, I can't think of the name of the country, but anyhow, they were slant drilling under the border of Iraq and stealing Iraq's oil. Saddam says, fuck this. He went down there and kicked their ass. The United States sort of said, well, we don't have any interest in it, but the minute they did it, they jumped on them, which was all part of the neocon plan to keep knocking off the leadership of these countries over there and take over, and then NATO to push around in Europe and so forth. It's all well planned by the neocons, Project for New America and all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, that's what slant drilling can do. It can get you killed. The Arizona court battle over proposed housing development hinges on still murky question of whether the state can allow the builder to pump groundwater that sustains a river that's under federal control. So you won't, you wetbacks won't have as many jobs drywall and putting up houses, because most of the construction, house construction in the Southwest in California is now in the hands of the mestizos. So anything that screws them up is good. They're going to have to go back to Mexico and live in their little hut. They're probably better off. In contrast, the prevailing law on rivers and streams is all too clear. The earlier someone stakes a claim on a stretch of water, the more bulletproof that owner's right to it. Don't forget, though, might makes right. If you've got the oldest claim on the river, you get to use the water regardless of what you're using for agriculture, industry, or whatever, said Gabriel Beckstein, a professor at Texas A&M University School of Law and lawyer with the Sullivan and Worcester. Quote, that's regardless of whether you're doing it efficiently, regardless of whether it's the highest use. I'll bet there's still trench irrigating out there in the Imperial Valley in California. 30 years after I told them you need to go to drip irrigation. In the rural west of the days past, when even arid climes held enough water for everyone, that principle worked well. In the booming west today, it's increasing recipe for conflict. That means fighting. That means war. That means shooting. The Lower Colorado River Authority in Texas decided last month to cut off water deliveries to rice farmers after concluding that the two reservoirs supplying Austin and the upstream towns were dangerously low at about 38% of capacity. The farmers had no recourse because they had no water rights. They had sold them to the authority decades ago. Well, the question is, where did that rice go that they're farming anyhow? Was that rice being shipped out of the country, like two-thirds or more of the corn that's shipped out of the Midwest that doesn't go for American use at all? So, but on the other hand, more water to the city means more population in the city, more non-whites in the city, more little bambinos in the city. The cutoff, nevertheless, has come to underscore the tinderbox relationship, tinderbox, keyword, between the state's rural past and its urban future. You don't have an urban future. These cities are going to become unlivable. It's going to be escape from Phoenix pretty soon. At a packed hearing before the administrative law judge last month, the farmers and others downstream complained that they were surrendering their water while Austin residents continue to wash their cars, their lowriders. Yeah, and in Mexican, I gotta wash my Chevy. Don't cut my water off to wash my Chevy. Groom golf courses. Well, that's the first place I'd cut all water to golf courses. Yeah, if I had the dictator power, you can't cry about water. I lived by golf courses. In fact, I do now. In Southern California, though, massive water is used on golf courses. Massive. It's unbelievable the amount of water they use on golf courses out here in, you know, in this arid Southern California or in Arizona and places like that. They should be, anytime there's a water shortage, cut off the golf courses. Tell those rich bastards to learn to play poker or something. Urbanites argue that drinking water reservoirs were not intended to irrigate farms. Huh. That point the farmers contest, and that recreational businesses along the reservoirs are going bankrupt. Yeah, the golf courses. A town on one of the reservoirs, Lake Travis, has to truck in water to keep taps flowing, they said. Oh, well, it's starting to affect the rich boys, the guys with money. Oh, hell, it's an emergency now. The tensions exist in every river basin in the state, Jason Hill, a water rights lawyer now representing the Texas city of San Angelo, in another rights dispute said, you don't really know the value of something until you run out of it and know you want it again. The water has historically been an unappreciated resource. Well, you had to know that weather changes. And you have to know that out there in the West is basically desert. And sooner or later you'd run out of water, it'd stop raining, man. Dumb shits. Across Texas, as an Austin rural interest clearly are waging rear guard battle. The Texas Water Development Board and the state's planning agency figures that cities' demand for water will rise nearly 75%. More people. While the use of water for irrigation will decline 17%. Hungry people. That's an interesting combination. Hungry people. Without water. I wonder what they do when they don't have any water to drink and they run out of food. By then, cities, not farmers, will be the dominant consumer of water, which since most of a big share of the people live in cities don't produce anything of value, they're just going to be parasites. You know, all those lawyers and all those white collar workers and everything, they don't produce a damn thing, just paperwork. But they want the water, baby, in my swimming pool, and I want to wash my chivy. But the farmers are not giving up without a fight. Well, it'll come to the Billy the Kid type situation, probably. Well, with a few sharpshooters up in the hills, they could pretty well keep those water boys at bay. In 2011, the Texas legislature gave a nod to the shifting priority, authorizing the state's Commission on Environmental Quality to suspend water rights in emergencies like droughts. Hey, don't drink there. I'm closing this spigot. While the commission still had a lot of water to rights holders in order of seniority, probably a lot of the banks, that seniority, a lot of that is held by banks, agribusiness. The legislature said it also could consider, as much as practical, how that water was being used before ordering the rights holders' pumps shut off. Oh, if they don't like what you, if you're growing pot, they probably won't shut your water off. They don't like you. No, I don't. Maybe they'll have you get most of the water. I don't know. More and more people want to smoke pot, I guess. And the price of pot is very high. A year later, when drought left the Dow Chemical Company's Freeport petrochemical plant short of Brazos River water, the company asked the commission to honor its 83-year-old water rights and to order more recent users to make up its shortage. In other words, that petrochemical company, when they moved in there, they bought up all the water rights from these farmers. And now they're saying, stand and deliver, baby. And the commission did, but only after deciding that 66 Texas towns and electric utilities should be exempted from a cutoff for health and safety reasons. Even though hundreds of farmers and others who lost their water held more senior rights. Indeed, court documents state the exempted towns and utilities held rights to 96% of the water affected by Dow's claim. The remaining 4%, mostly farmers like DeStefano, lost all right to irrigate their crops until the suspension ended several weeks later. In the ensuing lawsuit, DeStefano and others argued that the commission could not pick winners and losers when enforcing water rights enshrined in law. Yes, they can and they will. The big boys will have their way no matter what. And what are you going to do? Knuckle under, small farmers. Either that or strap on the gun. State law says the first time, first in time, first in right, that means what it says, said Joshua Katz, an Austin lawyer representing the farmers' interests. You see, they'll play both sides of the fence, those Jews. They always do. That's why people can't... Why would the Jews be in the Republican Party and the Democrat Party both? That means they don't agree with each other. Well, at the end of the day, they all come together. Prudent cities, he said, do what prudent farmers do to brace for drought. They buy more senior water rights. A trial court sided last year with the farmers, and the case is on appeal. But should the region's drought not let up, people here say further lawsuits in Texas and across the West are all but inevitable. It's truly a good time to be a water attorney in Texas, said Hill, the lawyer in San Angelo's dispute. There's work here as far as the eye can see. Well, when the lawyers get done arguing, the guns come out, baby, and there will be water wars. Mark my word, maybe it won't be in my lifetime, but it's coming. Well, I just came back from my luncheon, and I found out that some of my professional friends are telling me the water's getting worse around here. City water, they're having more and more trouble filtering out the gunk. They can get out the big pieces, but so it's the water problem's reaching back here in the Midwest, too. Now, I remember when I was a kid around here in the farming country, I never saw any kind of big irrigation going on at all. The rainfall took care of it. But not now. You see these great big machines that are about two blocks long working through a field irrigating. So my friend tells me that they're pumping massive amounts of water out of the ground for various reasons. In other words, sweet dreams, buddy. Thank you to Lone Wolf Las Vegas for that great article. Also, somebody a week or so ago asked me to play a certain song, and I was going to play it, but I lost it. So if you'll send me that request again, I'll do better this time. Did I record that, or did I have it off? I forget, but I was asking... In fact, I said there was somebody sent me a request for a song. Somebody requested me a request for a song last week, and I lost it. Send it again. And let's go back here and see if I can... And I asked about this recording control on the PC. I like to put a check mark on the stereo mix. That way I can put things that are pre-recorded on the show and also the microphone without changing, but it's been automatically flipping off of select, going over to microphone or line in, one of the two that I've got the stuff plugged into. Anyhow, you geniuses out there, let me know. Where was I? Where in the hell was I? Oh, religion has become a more effective way of imprisoning someone than with bars or chains. Modern religion is collective weakness. Well, and to be rude about it, it's insanity. Your strength comes from being an individual, army of one, private engineer. You don't call anyone for help. Don't help others. This is a common tactic the enemy uses against us. The scenario goes like this. You're in your home on a quiet morning when just outside your door a white woman is being brutally beaten by a black nigger. Your first instinct as an Aryan is to jump in and help. You must fight this feeling. The white woman is a prostitute junkie and the black male beating her is a dope dealer. Well, I don't care if she was a sweet upscale professional woman and he was a banker. Be the same thing. The enemy knows what our instinctual tendencies are, so he's always outthinking us. In this regard, never do what the enemy expects. They're watching, and we watch them. This is Zone 8, Charlie Sector, free and clear and out. There you go. Let's see. Now where am I at? Where in the hell is my... Oh, boy, I'll tell you. There it is. Question. Dear Tom, do you know anything about DNA ancestor tests? Not your gut personal opinion. Have you talked with any scientific people who have told you of the accuracy and integrity of them? Many thanks. No, I really haven't, because I don't even worry about it, because how many people can trace their ancestors back more than four or five generations? Like I heard this fellow, a Brit guy, said, could you trace your ancestors back to the Norman invasion? So before that, so what? as far as race is concerned, we consider, I think, third or fourth generation, you could have had a black person in your family tree. And if everybody since then would have bred true to their race, you'd be fine. It's just something else for people to think they're going to worry about. I mean, if you know enough to know whether you're English or Scotch or German or French or Italian or whatever, that's about all you need to know. Now, I've got one great big ancestral book that was put together on the when the computers just started coming in by a relative of mine at a major university. And, man, that thing goes back to, you know, this came from the Leiter name, which is on my grandmother's side, and Leiter in German means leader. And that goes all the way back to Lothar, who was a general in Rome. Can you believe that? How do you know that stuff? I mean, you know, it's really something. It's quite a book. But three or four generations is enough. You're white, look in the mirror, you know what you are. Okay. I don't think I'd play around with that stuff. I think it's a little bit like a Ouija board. Like with Craig Cobb, they said he might have had a little bit of black blood in him back 19 million generations. Well, that's ridiculous. So what? So what? So I had sent that one email out to the newspaper, I think it was. I don't know whether you got it or not, but I said, Craig Cobb's the finest nigger I ever knew. See, the Jews will use that stuff against you. Yeah, they'll use it for mental persecution. Scare you. Oh my God, there may be a nigger in my family way back there someplace. There may be an Indian back there, or maybe an Asian back there. And so you sit around, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. Well, Hitler ran into that problem in Germany. He was trying to trace his SS men back hundreds of years, and most of them couldn't do it. Of course not. So finally, he changed the whole rules of the thing. Because it's ridiculous to try to trace your ancestors back for hundreds and hundreds of years. White people are so gullible. Aryans are so gullible, and other races too. But this, what's this guy from the Himalayas? This all-knowing wise man is touring around. He's gone all over the world. He's even over in Israel now. Asian guy, a monk, smiling all the time, giving you all these platitudes. The air feels good. The sun is fine. If you stay in the sun too long, it is not productive. I mean, you know, all these so-called brilliant wise men, it's a bunch of shit as far as I'm concerned. They're con men. If that same guy was dressed in Levi's and a t-shirt and had long hair, you would never listen to him. But he comes out of the mountains of Asia with a sheet wrapped around him, and everybody believes everything he says. No wonder people are slaves. They want to be slaves. Most people are not forced to be slaves. They willingly become slaves. I don't know if you ever run into a couple where either one way or the other, the wife is so subservient, almost it's totally ridiculous, waiting on some guy hand and foot and bringing his slippers to him and everything. And then on the other hand, you find the other kind, the man that's like a pussy. He serves his wife every minute, every day, you know, like a slave. Yeah, people marry into slavery. They get into slavery in many ways. A lot of them get in slavery with drugs and alcohol and everything else. So when they say they don't like slavery, then, well, how come you get into it? Oh boy, I got taken to the woodshed again. I think part of the problem I get taken to the woodshed is people take things too literally. A lot of times I'm a little bit tongue-in-cheek, exaggerate some, and if you take it totally literally, here we go, I have to dispute your contention that if everyone in Washington disappeared and only the states were left, that somehow within weeks everything would be running fine. Well, not weeks, but they would gradually start running pretty damn good. I think that's a bit naive and buys into the argument that the states do everything better than simply, which simply is not true. Well, I don't know. Did we ever, we only gave them a chance for a little while here in Articles of Confederation. But the states under the Articles of Confederation were doing pretty damn good. I mean, they had they were producing their own money and everything. So I don't think there's enough track record of anybody being able to hold on to a state for a long enough time to make that judgment. The states themselves are an equal disaster to the D.C. cesspool. Well, I never said the states didn't have corruption. I never said that they were in fine shape. You can't take me so literally. Jesus, give me a break. Just look at the pension system collapse, all accomplished by individual states. Well, that's because they're mimicking the federal government. Every one of the states is mimicking the federal government. No, that's why they're so screwed. All accomplished by individual states, or how about the environmental disaster that states such as North Dakota, Oklahoma, Texas, and so on have brought to themselves for oil profits, and West Virginia and Pennsylvania for the coal profits? How about Texas, Kansas, North Dakota, and so on pursue? Well, that's because if there's an opening for greed, greed takes over. But a lot of that emanates from the federal and the corporations. Those corporations are more beholden to the federal than the state. The state are not, if the states were free to either succeed or fall on their ass, fine. People then would move to a state that operated better if they had a choice. So I wouldn't, the only reason I chalk that up to the states themselves is because they're trying to lean on the federal government to handle everything, like being slaves to Washington. But if you break that slavery and they have to think for themselves and think on a smaller scale, survival of the fittest, I think they would do pretty good. At least a lot better. Anti-abortion legislation, which virtually guarantees that MUDs will continue to outbreed whites, since MUDs already do that, despite the fact that they're also engaged in an abortion rate is almost three times as white. Well, yeah, you can't outbreed these bastards. Once you get millions of them in here, you can't outbreed them. You're not going to do that. The Republican Party uses that as another scare tactic to keep their Christian Zionists in line. They know that they're not going to succeed in that abortion. But they'll use those kind of social issues just to corral enough votes to get into office. And now take all these abortions away, and what do you have? Well, you have even more non-whites having babies. A lot more MUDs, it says. Let's look at your state, Indiana. Yeah! It isn't my state. My state is right here at my address. That's my state. I don't take responsibility for the rest of the state. How do you think Indiana would be if left completely on its own to enact and enforce any legislation that it wanted to? Well, I think I would be very active in politics, and I think there's a lot of other people that are not doing anything in politics would jump in and want to do something. But since you know you have no power to change anything the way it is, you don't get involved. It would be a neocon theocracy, wouldn't it? Well, I don't know quite what you mean there, neocon theocracy. Theocracy, that's ruled directly by God. Well, I think us non-God people could take things, change things a little bit. Now, you're looking for perfection. There isn't any, my friend. I'm telling you, you strive for something, but you'll never reach it. Never reach it totally. There is no nirvana, nothing like that. Life is struggle. And Texas would be even worse. How about running a budget? Well, people here in Indiana can count. More than 40 to 50 states have state budgets that are in deficit. Well, that's because they've leaned on a federal government. The federal government has taken the demand for survival of the fittest away. Just think how states such as those in the Bible Belt would be if left unchecked to enact any Christian-based laws on their population. That'd be fine, because there'd be an uprising and they'd get killed. You would be having kids pray in schools in no time. Now, kids can pray in school anytime they want. No, I know all these problems. But you'd have to start someplace. If the federal government and all these clowns at the top disappeared, then the people in the states would be forced, at least over a period of time, to change things and change things radically. Otherwise, forget it. There's no hope for anything. As bad as D.C. is, at least it does at least somewhat keep the churches and neocons from running completely wild and turning their states into mini-theocracies. Well, then how come they give them no taxes? How come the federal government doesn't collect taxes on churches? The day that the federal government taxes the churches, that's the day I'll begin to believe that they're a little bit on our side. I believe that despite how corrupt and depraved D.C. is, that it would become infinitely worse if the states were left to their own. Well, you're a Federalist. I'm not. We argued over this in the beginning of this country, and our side lost. So you got your central federalized government, and I don't think it's turned out too well. But if you're a Federalist, and I'm not, well, we're not going to come to any agreement. Let's remember that none of the states would enact a racial agenda. Who says they wouldn't? The states would have kept racial laws and Jim Crow laws if it hadn't been for the federal government and the greedy corporations and the big business. The states would, in the 50s, they didn't want to change, even though segregation is a poor form. It needs to be total separation. That's the problem. If you try to, you can have segregation, but it's difficult to enforce. The only difference I see is that the corrupt, abusive power wouldn't be gone. Instead, it would be concentrated more at the local level. Well, at the local level, I can reach out and grab the bastard. I never see my U.S. senator, but I see my state senator. I see those guys. I know where they live. You sleep with one eye open. I know where you live. If I want to get them, I know where they're at. Senators living in, U.S. senator living in Washington, D.C. He hardly ever comes home. So the closer they are to you, the closer government is to you personally, the more chance you have of controlling something. But again, I'm not saying that all this is perfect, because there is no perfection. Life is struggle. Politics is struggle. Race is struggle. And so you're never going to have a perfect situation. Anyhow, the last sentence this person says, that doesn't make things better, only different. Well, then let's just have a goddamn change for a while. I'm getting bored. Let's just throw it up in the air and let her come down and see which way it goes. Yeah. I'll let you take a swing at me, but on that one, I'm not letting you take me to the woodshed, because I don't think you're as right as you think you are. But anyhow, that's just a difference of opinion. Oh yes, here's an addendum to what this person sent to me. P.S. I forgot to mention all the right to work cheaply legislation. Unions would disappear tomorrow if conservative states were left to their own and could simply outright ban unions within their states. You know, it would not be long before every single conservative-dominated state did just that, and union organizing would become a crime. I see those states as workers' nightmares. Well, under the present system, yeah. But if it went back to the states, there'd be a hell of a lot of changes in the way people made a living and so forth. And I think there would be a lot, there'd be more direct action by workers against corporations if they got out of line physically like that. But some of this stuff is up in the air, and it's not going to be able to be proved by either of us. But I stick to my Confederation principles, that this country never should have been one centrally federalized country, and a whole lot of these states should have never been states in the first place. Out west, now we're saddled with all these desert-occupied areas and cities filling up with mongrels, so we probably never should have went too much farther than the Mississippi, maybe out to the eastern part of Nebraska, something like that. In fact, bringing Alaska in was that was a good deal, even though we're separated by quite a ways. Well, let's see, here's another one from an associate. Apparently the white man march that occurred this past Saturday will not be the last. I've been informed that there will be a march on the third Saturday of every month this year. I like the idea that the organizer of this event bans any KKK paraphernalia and all swastikas. But that will not stop any agent from the ADL or the SPLC posing as these Nazi freaks in order to incite a riot, which will pretty much destroy the whole purpose of the event. Lone wolf all the way. Well, I, you know, if you're going to have marches and people have difference of opinion and want to have different insignias, if you're going to be free and not be a hypocrite, I guess they should be allowed. I don't like to see it either, but you're still operating from the idea of convincing the public that you're nice. And if you don't wear a swastika, you're a nicer guy. I don't buy it. Right now, the other side's got all the power, and the public hate our guts. And no amount of parades is going to change that unless it's a parade in full camo with automatic weapons, and anybody that tries to stop them, shoot them down. And then you'll start seeing people be a little more respectful, but you got to have some power to be respected. And these marches, there's no power there. And the people watching know it, and very likely sometime they're going to storm these parades and beat the crap out of people. But that's not my business. They're doing their thing. They have every right to do it, or privilege, or natural right to do it. That's fine with me. It's their deal, and they rise or fall on their own merits. So if you want to march, march. I'm just saying I don't support it. I hate to use NS examples or Germany, but in the 20s they were getting their ass beat. They were out there trying to demonstrate in work clothes, and the communists were beating the hell out of them, and the cops were beating the hell out of them, and they were running gunfights and everything else. It wasn't until they got them all in brown shirts and sidearms and so forth that people started leaving them alone, because it exhibited power and it was no nonsense. If you come at us, we're going to kill you. And that's exactly the mentality of the cops and the military. And that's why they have so much power. They're not prepared to take that direction of travel. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you better stick to lone wolf and go at periscope depth until we can. And we can't now, other than suicide missions. I've never been a big one on suicide. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. Yeah, Thursday, 14/5. Let's have a little more Hank Williams III to close out here. What do you say?
Early one morning while making the round, I took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down. Went right home and I went to bed. I stuck that loving 44 beneath my head. Got up next morning and I grabbed my gun. I took a shot of cocaine and away I run. Made a good run, but I run too slow. They overtook me down in Juarez, Mexico. Laid in the hot joint, taking a pill. In walked the sheriff from Jericho Hill. He said, Willie Lee, your name is not Jack Brown. You're the dirty hack that shot your woman down. Yes, oh yes, my name is Willie Lee. If you've got a warrant, just read it to me. Shot her down, cause she made me slow. I thought I was her daddy, but she had five more. Train and they took me back. Had no friend for to go my bail. They slapped my daughter carcass in that county jail. The next morning about a 9:30, I spied a sheriff coming down the line. He kinda called as he cleared his throat. He said, come on you dirty hack to the district court. Into the courtroom my trial began, where I was held by 12 honest men. Just before the jury started out, I saw that dirty judge commence to look about. And walked a man holding the verdict in his right hand. The verdict read in the first degree. I hollered, Lordy, Lordy, have mercy on me. The judge smiled as he picked up his pen. 99 years in the Folsom State Pen. 99 years underneath that ground. I can't forget the day I shut that bad bitch down. Come on, you gotta listen on to me. Lay off that whiskey and let that cocaine be.
Sue it! You could say that again, man.